Support for The Exchange Friday New Hampshire News Roundup is made possible by Centrix Bank. See beyond with Centrix Bank.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. It's our Friday New Hampshire News Roundup. The Affordable Care Act continues to be a key issue in this year's political races, with Democrats defending the law and Republicans talking about repeal and replace. GOP congressional candidate Frank Ginter this week said many Republican plans include some of the ACA's most popular aspects, but Ginter said there's still a problem with the law's basic premise.
What I think people like myself want to change is this notion that the federal government is forcing individuals who don't want to purchase something. I just don't think that that is the best way to approach the reduction of cost and greater access.
Meanwhile, the law hit home this week with Granite State Health Providers. 9 hospitals here were penalized, along with 2,600 nationwide, under new Medicare rules concerning readmissions rates. In New Hampshire, St. Joseph's Hospital had the highest penalty, but the hospital's Dr. Richard Bowler said that's based on data collected up until June of last year.
Well, I don't think any of us in the state can afford to lose anything. If you were to take a snapshot today of readmissions, I think I'd come out smelling like roses.
Also in healthcare, veterans' access to nearby providers may soon be eased with the announcement of an expanded North Country facility. Deborah Amador is an official involved in the project.
Currently, we have about 2,400 veterans that get their care at the Littleton Clinic, and we certainly hope to attract additional veterans. This is going to provide us an opportunity to bring some additional services to the veterans that we serve in that area.
It's the Friday New Hampshire News Roundup today in The Exchange, and let's hear from you as we follow up on these and many other stories. Call in The Exchange number, 1-800-892-6477. 1-800-892-NHPR. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. Our guests for this week's roundup are Gary Reno, State House reporter for the Union Leader and New Hampshire Sunday News. And Gary, welcome back. Good to see you.
Thank you. Good to be here, Laura.
Also with us, Rick Stevens, Northern New England correspondent for the Associated Press. And Rick, thank you for taking time out. We appreciate it.
Good morning, Laura.
And also joining us for our first segment is Jack Rodolico. He's NHPR's healthcare reporter. And Jack, thank you also for being here. Appreciate
it. Thanks for having me.
Well, and Jack, I did want to start with you because there was a couple big healthcare stories this week that you followed up on. You had a piece just this morning, Jack, on how New Hampshire health providers are thinking about Ebola, preparing for the absolute worst. But set our minds at ease first a little, Jack, please. What did people tell you about the likelihood of this happening?
Slim to none. I guess if you were to watch cable news, you might get a little nervous as to what's going to happen in New Hampshire. But really, the odds of something coming into the state are really low. There's a lot of reasons for that. There's no direct traffic from northern New England into West Africa. Also, it's not an easy disease to transmit from one person to another. Well, I mean, it's not exceedingly difficult, but it's not exceedingly easy either. You have to have direct contact with somebody who's infected. So there's a couple steps there that make it unlikely. But then hospitals still are getting really prepared. We did see somebody in Texas who passed away because of Ebola this week. And so hospitals across the state and really across the country are working to put signage up to remind doctors to be asking patients about their travel history, if they have any kind of symptoms that might be related to having an Ebola infection. So signs in the hospitals, also just talking to communication between the state and the hospitals and the federal government. So there's a lot going on in the hospitals to get ready.
Wow, and they've got enough on their plate already with flu season and other issues coming up. How do you think they... How ready do they feel, Jack? I mean, did you get a sense of nervousness or did you get a sense of, you know, this is what it is, these are the procedures laid out by the federal government and we can deal with this?
Yeah. I mean, no doctor is going to say there is a zero chance of something happening.
Right.
But they seem extremely confident. You know, I talked to DHHS, the Department of Health and Human Services, an infectious disease specialist there, and she said she feels extremely confident that all of the hospitals across the state are highly prepared. Even in the worst case scenario where they had somebody come in, they're prepared to isolate that person and make sure that anyone who's coming in contact with them is also going through a lot of measures to make sure they're not transmitting something. So they feel pretty confident.
Yeah, Rick Stevens, you want to jump in?
Not only the medical community responding, Jack, but we see the military reaction now too.
The 101st Airborne Division is headed over to West Africa. We also have a Brigadier General right here from New Hampshire, a National Guard general headed over to help coordinate efforts to set up hospitals and other response agencies in West Africa to try and stem the disease there. So this is a wide-reaching, a far-reaching endeavor.
So, wow. So New Hampshire National Guard are going over there to help?
Well, at least a Brigadier General. He's going to help coordinate. We'll hear more about that this afternoon. The National Guard has set up an availability with the Brigadier General, who's actually in country now. He's in, I think, Liberia, and he's going to be over there for several weeks.
Wow. Brave man.
Well, that's one of the questions they ask, is that the soldiers are used to being in a hostile situation where they know who the enemy is and they can see the or hear the bullets coming. You can't hear Ebola coming, so that's one of the fears that they do have.
Well, another virus that's been on people's minds here in New England, Jack, although Ebola has obviously grabbed the big headlines, the enterovirus, what is that, Jack?
So enterovirus is...
Enterovirus, pardon me, yes.
It looks like entero, but they pronounce it entro, yeah. Enterovirus, there are many strains of enteroviruses. They're common respiratory infections. I saw something like 10 to 15 million Americans a year get an enterovirus. It presents like a chest cold.
So this isn't new?
No, but this particular strain of enterovirus is what has started in the Midwest sometime in the summer or fall and has spread to most states around the country. And so there are about 7 children who have gotten enterovirus in New Hampshire. Those are the latest numbers from the Department of Health and Human Services. Again, it's something that presents as something like a chest cold, but then at that point where a chest cold should sort of back off, it gets more aggressive. And at that point, parents are bringing their children in to their doctors and getting diagnosed with enterovirus. D68 is the particular strain, not that that really matters to most people listening. What they say is, first of all, you know, adults really aren't at risk. It's more children. And second of all, it's really among children who are at risk. It's children that have a history of respiratory problems like asthma. And you can really do a lot of very simple things. All the same, think of like a cold or a flu. All the things that you would be doing, washing your hands, not sharing cups, those types of things are what parents who are concerned about this should really be doing to protect their kids.
Does a flu shot protect against it?
My understanding is that it
does.
I don't know, to be honest. I doubt it, but I don't know the answer to that.
Right, right. Well,
I think we'd be hearing that that's the case.
Yes.
if that were true.
And the thing that's got people so concerned about this, right, Jack, is, you know, okay, it presents as a respiratory problem and then it gets worse instead of getting better. But there have been some pretty serious impacts from this. Ordinary chest cold.
No, there have been at least 2 deaths in the Northeast associated with this, one in Rhode Island, one in New Jersey.
Wow.
of children. So it does sound like a pretty frightening thing. At the same time, so long as you are – people shouldn't be terrified. You know, I mean, I think so long as you are doing the precautionary things that you would do, again, particularly for children with asthma and other respiratory issues, you should be, you know, all of the things that you normally do. One of the other things I heard is that not only hand washing and not sharing things, but also if your child has asthma and you see any symptoms of their asthma coming on, to treat it the same way you normally would, or maybe a little more aggressively, to give them their medication, their asthma medication immediately. So that's what we know.
All right. One more healthcare story that I want to follow up on, gentlemen. And again, remind everyone that the number for you to join the Friday New Hampshire News Roundup is 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange@nhpr.org. Again, 1-800-892-6477. You can find us on Facebook or Twitter. Lots of stories that we're catching up on the Roundup this week, including a couple big stories in the healthcare field. A little bit later, we'll catch up on the 2014 elections, especially the U.S. Senate race. You can join us right now at 1-800-892-6477. Jack, while we still have you, there was also news this week that more than 2,600 hospitals nationwide were penalized for their Medicare readmissions rates. Give us the big picture first, Jack. Why the focus on Medicare readmissions?
Sure. So first of all, what's a readmission, right? A readmission is Medicare takes a certain number of conditions that are fairly common, like pneumonia, heart failure or knee replacements. And they say if you go to a hospital, be treated for one of these things, and you come back within 1 month, that's a readmission. And, you know, that happens. It's fairly common. For Medicaid patients, it's about 1 in 5 – excuse me, Medicare. Nationwide, about 1 in 5 Medicare patients who go into the hospital to be treated for one of these things comes back within a month. And the federal government basically says that's too many.
Yeah, it's expensive.
It's expensive,
and do a better job the first time. Do a better job when people leave with the right instructions.
And it's, and I think that's a big part of it. This all is tied back to the Affordable Care Act, and this is a provision of the Affordable Care Act that's trying to get hospitals to think a little bit more long-term and try to tie their bottom line to how they're treating people long-term and keeping their communities healthy, not just the amount of care that they provide. So the federal government looks and says, okay, so who do we have leverage over when it comes to the general population? What population can we use to leverage hospitals? And it's really the Medicare population. So what they're saying is that for every individual hospital around the country, if you're readmission rate for Medicare patients is higher than we think it should be. It's higher than the national average adjusted for each hospital. Then we're going to pay you less next year. For every dollar that we give you, we're going to give you a little bit less. So the maximum penalty, this is the third year they're doing it. The penalties are now maximized to 3%. So what that means is if you receive the maximum penalty, every dollar that Medicare gives you next year, they're actually going to give you 97 cents. So for every buck they owe you, they'll give you 3 cents less.
It starts to add up. I mean, it doesn't sound like a lot on a dollar-by-dollar basis, but it starts to add up, Jack, right?
Right. And if you look at New Hampshire, so about half the hospitals in the state are exempt from this penalty because they're too small. Uh-huh. So among the ones that are subject to it, most of them receive the penalty. 9 out of, I think, 13 received it. And the mostly that our average is a little below the national average. They did pretty well. But St. Joseph's Hospital is twice the national average. They're going to receive a 1.2% penalty, which, again, that's, you know, 98.6 cents or something on the dollar is what they're going to be paid for the next year. But, you know, the thing that was really interesting to me when I looked into this is that, OK, so it sounds like a lot. St. Joseph is going to receive something like 180 to 200,000 less dollars from Medicare less next year. Seems like a big dollar figure.
Right.
But when you look at their overall revenue, it's like a tenth of a hundredth of a percent of their revenue. But it seems to be having an impact on hospitals, and they're driving down their readmission rates for that and other reasons that they're taking on for themselves.
Well, every penny counts, so I'm sure you're looking at it. Jack, thank you so much for being with us. Really appreciate it.
My pleasure.
That's Jack Rodolico. Again, he's NHPR's health reporter. Coming up, our digital reporter will join us. We'll catch up on all the electioneering that took place this week. This is the Friday New Hampshire News Roundup on NHPR. This is the Friday New Hampshire News Roundup on NHPR. I'm Laura Kanoy. We're catching up on all the week's top news stories here in the Granite State. And you can join us, 1-800-892-6477, email exchange at nhpr.org. Again, 1-800-892-6477. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. Our guests for the hour are Gary Reno, State House reporter for the Union Leader in New Hampshire Sunday News, and Rick Stevens, Northern New England correspondent for the Associated Press. And joining us now for a few minutes is Brian Walston, digital reporter for NHPR. And Brian debates and forums and ads. Oh, my. Let's catch up on the midterm elections.
Good morning, Laura.
This week, some of your digging and reporting on the U.S. Senate race made national news and caused a kerfluffle in the Senate race. What happened?
Well, I don't know that it took a whole lot of reporting. These bills that are at issue in the dueling ads this week go back to 2003 when Scott Brown was in the Massachusetts House, and in 2005 after he became a state senator. And they're known as women's right to know legislation. And among their provisions is one that says at least 24 hours before an abortion, the doctor's agent or referring physician has to is required to provide the pregnant women certain information, and that includes either color photographs or, quote, realistic drawings of the unborn child at 2 weeks interval. And as I said, these bills they came up in 2010 race, and when Brown beat Martha Coakley in a special election to replace Ted Kennedy, in 2012 when he beat Elizabeth Warren.
When Elizabeth Warren beat him.
Right, when he Yes, right, right. And in the Warren race, Brown was frequently under attack from the abortion rights groups for these bills, but also for co-sponsoring the Blunt Amendment, which would have allowed employers to deny insurance coverage for birth control and other services if they violate their moral or religious convictions. He took issue with these ads this week, called it despicable, called it a smear. On the other side, I don't think this is a surprise coming from the Shaheen camp because it was a big issue in the Warren race. And he's suffering the same sort of dynamic in this race that he was in Massachusetts, is that there's a significant gender gap. And, I think Warren had him by 18 to 20 points over women. And right now, Brown is trailing Shaheen among women by 15 to 20 points, depending on the polls.
So the Shaheen folks are pushing this. They're saying, look, his record on abortion is unclear. And Scott Brown is coming back and saying, look, I'm pro-choice. Look at my whole record, right? I mean, he's kind of saying, don't tie me with the anti-abortion.
Right. And, certainly I think Brown, compared to a lot of Republicans, would probably be a little more sympathetic to pro-choice viewpoints. But, he does have a record, and it's certainly legitimate for his opponents to point out that he did co-sponsor these bills. Now, he's saying these are adoption bills and that there are certain elements of them that could have been up for debate during the legislative process. And he points out that it was 9 to 10 years ago that they came up and that they actually never made it out of committee, which, that's true. I think, might be fair to point out that the Washington Post had a fact checker this morning on it, took issue with Shaheen's use of the word force in the ad because it's not in the legislation. The legislation says require. That might be splitting hairs a little bit, but then also said that Brown probably was protesting way too much on this.
All right. And Rick Stevens, Gary Rand, I'd love to get your thoughts. Maybe, Rick, either on this issue that Brian's been looking into or just more broadly this U.S. Senate race. There was a lot of activity on this race this week, not only the dueling ads that Brian talks about, Gary Reno, but they had a debate this week, right, Brown and Shaheen?
They did. But to get back to a little bit to the point that Jack was talking about, we've had these bills, very similar bills here in New Hampshire, and they're often called informed consent bills. And, they usually come from the anti-abortion legislatures. It's not like this is a bipartisan sort of endeavor or people from both sides trying to promote abortion. Promote adoption. So to say that, this isn't some sort of link to this anti-abortion is kind of stretching it because that's where all of this stuff – there are very similar bills that have come in this state and other states and so on. And so they're coming from some sort of bank someplace. Mm-hmm. And, he put his name to this, so, he doesn't have a lot to complain about really.
Rick, what do you think about this race overall? Do we see it tightening, the gender gap stuff that Brian mentioned?
Oh, well, that's where I wanted to go next was the gender gap. And in a campaign that has been particularly nasty, I think this has been one of the rougher campaigns I've seen. This issue really generated instant blowback and really harsh blowback from both sides. They dug in fast and hard. And I think it does get to the point that Brian mentioned with the 15 to 20% gap, the gender gap that Shaheen now enjoys over Brown. One of the things, too, to get back to Gary's point, when you have a record, you have a record to run on. And Brown has to acknowledge that record. He tried to say during this issue this week that, well, yeah, I put the amendment in, but you often put amendments in that you don't expect to pass. Well, I don't know if that really passes the laugh test, and we'll see if women voters think it does.
All right. Again, the number here on the Friday New Hampshire News Roundup is 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. Brian, did you want to jump in real quick on this, and then I want to ask you guys about Frank Ginter?
That I think is interesting that he went out immediately to respond to this because he did not respond in 2002 and 2003, 2005. He sort of let it go. This time, I think he sees it as a clear threat, and so he immediately pushed back on it. So.
Well, in other political news, our campaign series, Rudman Center Conversations with the Candidates, continued. And Brian, you and I have been working a lot on these, and I want to let everybody know how much you've helped me prepare for these forums, so I appreciate that. What struck you, Brian, from that forum that we did this week with former Congressman Ginta?
Well, how moderate he sounded. You know, it's interesting. I think you're going to play this clip that he talked about with the on national security. But, you know, Dan Innes in the primary in the debate, he, you know, said you either stand with terrorists or you stand with freedom. When you brought up this again, this time he was talking much more about balance. I mean, you know, he was in the primary before. Now it's a general election. And, you know, I think there's more of an appetite for that type of red meat in the primary. But, you know, it was kind of I thought it was interesting that he said that people are frustrated with the negativity of campaigning and policy discussions. You know, what was surprising was to me was how much he sort of played up bipartisanship in Congress,
yes.
Which, you know, most people don't associate with that body. But he actually put a what I would suggest was a shout out to his opponent, Congresswoman Shea Porter, saying, you know, this is a difficult body, but they're doing the people's work, and that 90% of the bills that go through there pass with some bipartisanship support. He's not attacking Obama, you know, using the president as the main foil in this race like other races are, like, you know, like Scott Brown might be doing in the Senate race.
But isn't he using Nancy Pelosi as the foil? I mean, he keeps tying Shea Porter to Nancy Pelosi. So, I mean, it's the same sort of technique going on.
Well, I did want to, since Brian raised it, it's interesting to me that the issue of national security versus you know, privacy has come up in particular in this race, partly because of, as you said, Brian, in the primary, partly because of some votes that Carol Shea Porter has taken. Let's just play a little piece of that interaction where I did ask former Congressman Ginta, when you said you either stand with the terrorists or not, what he was trying to say there. So let's hear what he had to say.
Well, you do have to have a balance between protecting America and also ensuring American privacy rights. This is a very challenging time that we're in, and it's why it's the most important time to make sure that we get it right. There are a lot of people who are concerned about the challenges of how do we ensure that those fighting in Iraq and Syria don't somehow either access our country or create, you know, a sleeper cell a lone wolf here or somebody that tends to react based on an ideology that they somehow have transferred to over time.
Well, again, that's Frank Ginta talking at our Rudman Center Conversations with the candidates that we've been doing in partnership with UNH Law. By the way, if anybody wants to listen back to those interviews, they're all on our website, nhpr.org. You can join us now, too, with your questions and comments about some of the politicking that we saw around the Granite State this week. There was a lot going on. 1-800-892-6477 is our number. And in Hudson, Jillian's on the air. Hi, Jillian, go ahead.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I'm a big fan of the show, and I actually listened to the interview with Congressman Ginta earlier this week, and I was really shocked that when you asked him about the new personhood language that was added to the GOP platform in New Hampshire, that he didn't oppose it. You know, I am a woman who uses an IUD for contraceptives, and, you know, considering a fertilized egg a person, you know, would threaten IVF, you know, using IUDs and other kinds of birth control and emergency contraceptives that, you know, I think that women rely on. And I was really shocked that he didn't come out opposed to that, even when you kind of pressed him on it.
Well, Jillian, thank you for listening and thank you for the phone call. And Brian, this is another series of questions that we talked about with Congressman Ginta.
Well, he didn't say he opposed it. He didn't say he supported it.
And the clock was ticking.
it was at the very end of the forum, as
right.
I recall. And I mean, I didn't say he took some pains, but he did not answer the question about whether he supported it or opposed it.
And Scott Brown was quite clear when we talked to him that he did not agree with this personhood amendment plank.
Right. And, you know, I mean, it's fine. It's a plank in a platform. Politicians aren't, you know, obligated to agree with it or take a position on it. You know, whether or not to, but I thought it was because he has supported these things in the past, these types of amendments and legislation, and he just didn't take a position on it this time.
Well, thanks for the call, Jillian. And here's an email that came in from Jack. Jack says, Frank Ginta will, according to his TV ad, quote, fight to help middle class families. families pay for child care. Friendly Frank also told Laura Kanoy that the federal government should provide resources, i.e. money, without strings attached. Like a lot of conservative Republicans, he's conservative not about money, but only about strings. But what could be more anti-conservative than the idea that the federal government should give away money without condition as to how it is spent? Jack, thank you for the email. This is something, guys, that came up in the first part of the forum, and I think I'll turn to you one more time, Brian, where I asked Congressman Ginta, okay, if you go back to Washington, you know, your big priorities, and he kind of said bringing home the bacon.
Yeah, I mean, and with, you know, non-controversial type subjects, security or public safety, health care and education. You know, I would take a little bit of an issue with the caller or the emailer. He did talk a lot about oversight and about trying to make sure these programs, whatever they are, show some sort of benefit or cost-benefit analysis. I mean, he did use the word oversight a lot in the conversation.
All right. Well, Brian, thank you very much for being with us this hour.
My
and
pleasure,
we've got four more forums ahead of us, so we'll be talking about that. Thanks for being with us, Brian. That's NHPR's Brian Walston, our digital reporter. By the way, his piece for Scott Brown, Renewed Focus on Abortion Bills, Deja Vu, is on our website, nhpr.org, so you can check it out there. 1-800-892-6477 is the number. You can send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Jack, thanks for that one. You can find us on Facebook or Twitter. Gary Reno, Rick Stevens, a couple more political races that I wanted to follow up on with you guys. Now, in the governor's race, crime and punishment has become an issue. How come, Rick?
It came up, pardon me, it came up this week. Walt Havenstein at a debate mentioned that, or at a campaign stop, mentioned that his stepmother, Mary Havenstein, had been the victim of a crime. She was killed during a robbery. She died as the result of a robbery, I should say.
That's a terrible story.
It's a terrible story.
He said that he had not intended to make this part of his campaign.
No, he never had intended it to be public. His stepmother, Mary Havenstein, was living outside of Maryland in 2008, and a man who had been connected to several other crimes broke into her house, robbed the house, and she died as a result.
Yeah.
Walt Havenstein mentioned it in the context not of his it didn't form his public safety or criminal justice opinions, but it helped, in his words, it helped solidify his respect for the law enforcement community. And that was the message he was trying to convey. He was very, very reticent to talk about it, even going to the point of, after mentioning it at this campaign event, he called his siblings to tell them, hey, this is out there now.
Wow.
So he's very demure on this topic, but it has now become an issue in a campaign that I don't think anybody expected public safety to become, despite – and Gary can talk a little bit more about this early release of inmates in New Hampshire prisons, which has become sort of an issue.
Well, it's interesting. You say that, you know, few people – and you're right, Rick – expected public safety to become a campaign issue. Gary, we've been down this road before, right? Remember 2010?
2010.
All of a sudden,
it was big issue.
This became an issue again.
I mean, we had a bill which was called the
Governor's race.
In the governor's race. And we had a bill the year before called the Justice and Reinvestment Act, which basically said we're going to release prisoners early, we're going to get them services, we're going to reacclimate them to the community, and that way we hope they don't come back because we have too many people coming back. It's filling our prisons. It's costing us a lot of money. And everything was fine.
SB 500 was the bill.
It had bipartisan support.
Big kumbaya movement.
And then it became a huge political issue in the governor's race between John Stevens and John Lynch. And before then, of course, the other part of it was that the first couple of people that they released were kind of bad apples who got themselves into trouble right off the bat. And it became even a bigger issue. And before the next legislature was done, we totally pretty much gutted the program.
Yeah. So how surprised are you, Gary, to see this kind of coming up again?
Well, it's come up in a couple of forums, both before the legislative committee and in the governor's race. Because largely it would work. I mean, and the data that was gathered showed that it basically did work. But, I mean, typically it got caught up in the political scene. It got caught up in the budget problems. And it never really went to any kind of fruition. So, you know, it's one of those issues that's kind of one of those little hot buttons that sends people into space sometimes. And it's not a real surprise that it's coming up in this race because there isn't an awful lot that has been that in the governor's race.
Yeah, and we'll be talking with Walt Havenstein on October 20th. We talked to Governor Hassan about a week and a half ago. Rick, did you want to jump in
just real quick
on that?
Yeah, the notion of a hot button issue. It's the easy ones to get your head around. You know, public safety. We see now where Ebola has become a political issue related to the security of the southern border. Scott Brown has said the Ebola threat is further evidence that we need to secure our southern border and keep people from creeping into the country with illnesses such as this. It may border a little bit on fear-mongering if you look deeply enough into it.
Well, I got an email here from Rob. And Rob, thank you for emailing us. He says, Brown seems to be running a very positive campaign, while Shaheen has resorted to exclusively attack/smear ads. Rob says, can your guests point to any positivity from the Shaheen camp?
Well, I think, I mean, let's be honest, they're both attacking each other. They both have done very little positive, you know, issues out there. It's largely been an attack campaign on both sides. And I think that's one of the reasons. I think it's part of the reason a lot of people are sort of turning off this election. It's just so much of that it's becoming a little too much.
Well, and Rob, we'll have a better answer for you maybe midweek next week. We're going to do a whole program on some of the advertising and themes in these campaigns and where the truth may be. So thank you for the email, Rob, and we'll follow up a little bit more next week. The number for you to join us here in The Exchange is 1-800-892-6477. You can send us an email like Rob did at exchange@nhpr.org or find us on Facebook or Twitter. Coming up, one more race that I want to look at with you gentlemen, the second congressional district race between Custer and Garcia. Also, we'll find out more about New England's biggest pumpkin, where it comes from. You guessed it, right here in the Granite State. We'll find out more. This is the Friday New Hampshire News Roundup on NHPR. This is The Exchange on NHPR. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today, it's our Friday New Hampshire News Roundup. And we'd love to hear from you as we follow up on some of the big headlines of the week, from healthcare to elections. A little bit later, we'll talk about farming in the Granite State. 1-800-892-6477 is the number for you to join us. Email us at exchange@nhpr.org. Again, 1-800-892-6477. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. Gary Reno's here, State House reporter for the Union Leader and New Hampshire Sunday News, and Rick Stevens, Northern New England correspondent for the Associated Press. And gentlemen, I do want to turn away from the 2014 campaign in just a moment, but very quickly, we should update Rick Stevens, the latest on the second congressional district race between Emma Klain Custer and Marylinda Garcia.
This is turning into an interesting race. I think it's we all expect polls to tighten up as we get closer to November. That's normal. But this is now, I think, in the latest numbers from the UNH Survey Center, or maybe it was the Granite State poll. Either one, it's essentially a statistical tie between Custer and Garcia. This has been a very forceful campaign on both parts. They met. They didn't meet this week. It was more of a forum where they had it wasn't a debate format, but they were able to discuss mostly economic and business issues with the Nashua Chamber of Commerce. One of the things that sort of struck us about this forum was they were discussing grants to improve rail service in New Hampshire. And
big issue for the Nashua Chamber. They really want
big
rail.
Issue for the Nashua Chamber. And Marylinda Garcia seemed to be caught a little bit by surprise at one point, saying that she just didn't know enough about it to be able to say whether she would support this kind of whatever comes out of a feasibility study. Gary, I think it's due this year, the feasibility study.
Right.
And at one point, the moderator, the Chamber of Commerce president, sort of sharply said, you know, you can't be naive or ignorant about these issues if you want to be the representative from this district. So seemed to play into the notion that a relatively untested state representative, Marylinda Garcia, might not be ready for the big show yet. That seemed to be the implication there.
And then he also, though, from what I understand from the report you guys did, Rick, at the AP, also said to Ann McLean Custer, you know, you sponsor this bill, you sponsor that bill, but none of them pass. So, you know, how are we to measure your effectiveness? That's something that we actually talked with Shaheen about, too. I mean, people introduce bills all the time, but if they don't go anywhere,
That's right. And that's what the, again, when you do have a record, you have a record to run on, and there are some successes and some failures in both parties, and Democrats and Republicans alike, regardless of who controls the chamber. Now, obviously, Amalcaine Custer is in the House minority, but Gene Shaheen is in the Senate majority. So you can say, is it a function of the way the chambers work in Washington? Or?
Yeah. Gary, go ahead.
And I mean, we have a divided Congress in Washington, too, so that doesn't help matters. And I mean, this last Congress has passed fewer bills than almost any Congress in decades. So, I mean, it's a real problem down there.
And I think an analysis showed that most of the bills were naming post offices and stuff like that.
So, nothing really substantial gets through.
You know, Rick said something interesting, Gary, that I want to ask you about, too. He mentioned the polls are tightening in this race. Now, this is a district that tends to lean more Democratic or has in recent years. So what's happening there?
Well, it's hard to say at this point, but there's been an awful lot of negativity all around in all the races. And the term is called dirty air. And what happens when you have all the dirty air, oftentimes everybody gets painted with it, everybody who's out there. And even if Anne McLean Custer had a lead at some point, I mean, she gets sort of lumped in with everything else, and all of a sudden it becomes sort of like, well, I don't, it's anti-incumbency or whatever, and it just closes everything right up.
Mm. The district may lean a little bit Democratic. We know what I'm finding really interesting in New Hampshire politics is that large block of undeclared voters, unaffiliated voters. The independents, both in the House First District and the Second District, far outnumber either of the two main parties, and they're really the ones that they're going to have to start going after to determine this election. Yeah. I mean, we look at House the First District, where it's gone back and forth in the last three cycles. So,
and I mean, it's no secret in New Hampshire that there aren't enough Democrats to win elections, and there aren't enough Republicans to win elections. You win elections with the independents. That's how whoever they break for is who's going to get elected.
All right. Again, the number for you to join us on the Friday New Hampshire News Roundup is 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange@nhpr.org. Again, 1-800-892-6477. You can find us on Facebook or Twitter. Speaking of elections, guys, there was an election this week for the head of the State Employees Association. Now, Gary, we don't need to spend a lot of time on this, but that's a pretty prestigious post a lot of politicking.
It does an awful lot of politicking. It's gotten more visible over the years, particularly as we've become more attuned to what's going on in terms of labor relations with the state and so on, and healthcare issues and so on. But it's also fairly typical that the SEA turns out a president after a couple of years. I mean,
Diana Lacy,
who was the president, won an election 4 years ago against the person who was the incumbent. And now they had the convention last weekend, and Richard Gulla, who is a store manager for the Liquor Commission, won an election by 4 votes over Diana Lacy.
Boy, that's close.
And it was very close. From what I can understand from some of the people that were there, Gulla basically was pushing, let's take care of the union and some of our issues first. Let's pull back a little bit on all this political activity that we've been doing. And I think that sort of resonated with some of the membership.
Another story that caught my eye this week, Rick, was the effort by longtime state rep Rennie Cushing, a Democrat from the Seacoast area, says he plans to introduce a yes means yes bill. This is aimed at reducing the amount of college campus sexual assaults. Can you explain this, Rick?
Yes means yes, or it's also called affirmative consent. It means that both parties must verbally agree to engage in sexual activity, or there's an actionable offense occurring. This is in response to a growing concern about sexual abuse on college campuses. Here in New Hampshire, Dartmouth College is under investigation federally for its handling of sexual abuse cases. University of New Hampshire is widely lauded for its policies that take a sharp stand. The difference, we've all heard for years, the phrase no means no. This is the yes means yes, and what it does is it puts the onus on the actor, the person who wants to engage in sexual activity, rather than making the victim responsible for are rejecting in advance. So, and
wow, that's a big mind shift, isn't it?
It's a complete mind shift. And under Representative Cushing's bill, if you don't come up with policies that incorporate this language, you risk your state aid or for private colleges. And this is the way he can get to the Dartmouth question. You can get you can lose your property tax exemption as well.
Oh, wow.
Exactly. So this it just passed – a similar bill just passed in California. I think New York State is also weighing a similar bill.
And yeah,
I think
this is a movement nationwide,
sure,
right?
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. So what do you think, guys? What are some of the issues that are going to come up when this is debated at the State House? I mean, there's been some pushback to these, right, Gary?
Oh, there has been. People are going to say, well, it's the college environment and what are we trying to do? Trying to change what's been a tradition for years and years and years. I'm sure there'll also be a lot of people who are saying, well, you know, you're asking too much of people that are young that really aren't adults in a large extent. And people are just going to say, you're going to have to really change the judicial system, the justice system, because it's all geared at this point the other way.
Yeah. Well, we'll hear those arguments being made, and then we'll hear the other side as well. And, you know, colleges will probably say, look, we can't legislate people's behavior, but the state will say, and Rennie Cushing will say, we have to try. Yep. We have to start somewhere. So, all right. Well, that will be very interesting. I want to go back to our callers, and John is waiting in Salem. Hi, John. Go ahead. You're on the exchange.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I just wanted to comment on the Custer-Garcia race.
Sure.
And here in Salem, Garcia was our state rep up until recently. And we had for the casino bill, we had a townwide referendum. 81% of the town voted in favor of a casino at the Rockingham Park. And Garcia completely disregarded that, voted against the bill. And based on that and based on her just poor track record of even showing up at the state house, we overwhelmingly voted against her for congressman.
Well, John, this is real interesting, and I want to let you know that at our forum with Ginta, I had a Republican come up to me and mention this exact same issue, saying, hey, he was Republican and, you know, he would support Garcia, but he was also upset about this Salem casino vote. Here's my question for you, though, John. Okay, so is it the role of a state rep to vote what he or she thinks the people want or his or her conscience? What do you think?
Well, I think if there's no overwhelming indicator of what the people want, then they should vote the conscience. That's what we elect the officials for. But if the people vote and obviously have a preference, then they should respect those wishes.
Okay. Good to hear from you, John. And we'll definitely be talking to Representative Garcia about this when she joins us at our Rudman Center Conversations with the Candidates forums. Either of you guys want to jump in on this? I've heard from a couple people in the Salem area that they are upset with this vote.
Well, I mean, she said very plainly, we asked her when she was in the union leader the whole thing about the same issue. And she said, well, I mean, I've clearly stated on my website, I clearly stated in forums and everything that I oppose gambling. So it shouldn't be a surprise to anybody that I voted against it. And fair enough.
There are certain issues, Gary, right, that are more votes of conscience than
gambling is one of them. It's not really a partisan issue. There are it goes across both ways. Democrats hate it. Democrats love it. Republicans hate it. Republicans love it.
Yeah.
So it's a vote of conscience, and she just has opposed it, and she was very upfront about the fact that she opposed it.
Well, in Salem, they sure seem to love it. And I really appreciate the call, John, because this has definitely been an issue. So thank you. Here's an email from Wayne who says, I would differ with the person who said the Shaheen campaign has been negative. That was another one of our emailers. I think Rob said Shaheen has been all negative. Wayne's disagreeing with Rob. Wayne says Gene Shaheen has been running commercials highlighting the constituent services that have made real changes in real lives. As someone who served with Senator Shaheen in the New Hampshire Senate, I can tell you that she genuinely cares about people and sees her job as a chance to make the lives of people in New Hampshire better. So Rob's got one feeling and Wayne has another, and I appreciate both of you guys chiming in on our show. It's great to hear from so many people on the Friday New Hampshire News Roundup. I did want to ask you, Rick Stevens, about another story that I looked at and went, wow, what's that about? And that has to do with 9 counties in New Hampshire receiving USDA, U.S. Department of Agriculture, disaster declarations. Now, it didn't seem to me, Rick, that we had any major floods this summer or droughts in the summer or floods in the spring or heat waves or tornadoes. I mean, didn't seem very disastrous.
This one's is temperature related, and I was shuddering this morning as I walked out of the house. And, so winter's coming back to us. Last winter was very cold, and these grants, they're up to $2 million for agricultural, you know, growers and farmers. But because of the wide temperature variations, the fluctuations between December and April, and that kind of variation, if you have a consistent temperature, your crops are more resilient, they're more able to withstand it. But it's when they swing widely that the farmers say that causes the damage. It can cause the fruit buds not to develop properly, et cetera. So, yeah, all nine counties except for Coos are eligible for these USDA grants.
Wow. Yeah, I was going to ask you about who the outlier was, because New Hampshire has 10 counties, nine of them. So this isn't sort of massive, you know, post-Katrina or post-Hurricane Sandy aid. It's sort of you can get low-interest loans to help you out because we feel bad about what happened. That's
right.
Basically,
yep.
It. Yeah.
Yep. That's right.
Gary, do you want to jump in?
Well, Coos, it's left out because you could get a frost at any time of the year in Coos County.
You kind of got to be prepared for that. Well, okay, so speaking of difficult weather for farmers, didn't seem to hurt a pumpkin grower in Farmington. I guess they don't mind the wacky weather, Rick.
Was it 1,500 pounds?
No, it's 1,900
pounds. That's, all right, let's get the joke out of the way. It's the great pumpkin, to be sure. My question on a pumpkin that big is, what do you carve it with? That's got to take a chainsaw, right?
Right. So tell us what happened. This is a big honor for New Hampshire, right,
well,
Gary?
It was the largest pumpkin ever grown in New Hampshire. So it was you have to kind of backstep here a little bit. You know, these things have lineages like racehorses do. You know, it's something I learned. I didn't know this before. So this pumpkin came from a long line of large pumpkins, so to speak. And this farmer in Farmington, Hiram Watson, that's a familiar name to the people over in that area for agriculture. They have a large family farm over there. And he nurtured this little pumpkin along since April, basically, and it got so. And he entered another one actually in the Rochester Fair, which was also a winner, but it wasn't quite as large. It was like 1,600 pounds.
So how big is this one?
19, almost a ton.
Almost a ton.
Almost a ton. But
wow.
You have to enter it in a sanctioned event, a giant pumpkin Commonwealth organization event, which is only in Topsfield Fair down in Massachusetts.
How did he get it down there?
They had to wench it out of and put it on a truck and take it down. And I mean, it's if you've ever seen any of these, and I've seen some of them over in the Hopkinton Fair in years past, I mean, these things are huge. I mean, you just all sit there and say, how many pumpkin pies could you make from this?
Right. Yeah. If you had the time to
carve
it
up, but how are you going to carve it up?
Yeah. Right. Wow. I wonder how he knew that this was the one, you know, to put a blanket on and extra fertilizer and all that.
Well, if you read John Nolan's story from the Newton or Rochester Times, I mean, he actually really – he did everything but, like, cut off the vines. He thought this one was going to be the big one because he could tell by the way it was growing. So he cut off all the other vines so this would get all the nutrients and all the water and everything. So.
Well, gentlemen, real quickly, next week on The Exchange, as I told everybody earlier, we are going to take a closer look at those political ads that everybody loves to hate. So we'll follow up on that next week. Also, we're going to take a break from politics. We're going to talk about how a trip to Mars is becoming less and less science fiction and more science fact. So we have a lot of fun stuff going on here in The Exchange next week. How about you, Gary? What are you up to next week?
Well, we always have, it's getting closer and closer to the election, so we have more and more politics going on all the time. But we also have the Executive Council coming up on Wednesday, and what has become quite interesting here in the last few months or so is the Site Evaluation Committee and her nominees to that. So that will be coming up Wednesday.
Okay, how about you, Rick?
Two political heavyweights coming to town, Mitt Romney for Scott Brown and Bill Clinton coming on Wednesday, the real showstopper for the Democratic Party. So it'll be an interesting week in politics.
That's right. I forgot to ask you guys about the presidential hopefuls.
Rand Paul is coming back, too.
Rand Paul, that's right.
Right.
And George Pataki.
I haven't seen him in a while.
The past.
Okay. Thank you so much for being here, gentlemen. I know you're busy. I really appreciate it. Rick, it was good to see you. Thank you.
Same here, Laura. Thanks.
Rick Stevens, Northern New England correspondent for the Associated Press. Gary Reno, thank you as always.
Oh, you're welcome, Laura.
Gary Reno, State House reporter for the Union Leader and New Hampshire Sunday News. The Exchange is a production of NHPR. The senior producer is Ellen Grimm. The producer is Faith Meixel. Our engineer is Dan Colgan. Our theme music was composed by Bob Lord. And I'm Laura Kanoy.